He was your friend, wasn't he?
Oh, shut up!
He remained silent, not looking at her. When his eyes came back to her face, she was still watching him, and she spoke first, her voice oddly stern. What your sister did in her radio broadcast was great.
Yes, I know. You've been saying that for a month.
You've never answered me.
What is there to answer?
Just as your friends in Washington have never answered her. He remained silent. Jim, I'm not dropping the subject. He did not answer. Your friends in Washington never uttered a word about it. They did not deny the things she said. They did not explain. They did not try to justify themselves. They acted as if she had never spoken. I think they're hoping that people will forget it. Some people will. But the rest of us know what she said, and that your friends were afraid to fight her.
That's not true. The proper action was taken, and the incident is closed, and I don't see why you keep bringing it up.
What action?
Bertram Scudder was taken off the air as a program not in the public interest at the present time.
Does that answer her?
It closes the issue, and there's nothing more to be said about it.
About a government that works by blackmail and extortion?
You can't say that nothing was done. It's been publicly announced that Scudder's programs were disruptive, destructive, and untrustworthy.
Jim, I want to understand this. Scudder wasn't on her side. He was on yours. He didn't even arrange that broadcast. He was acting on orders from Washington, wasn't he?
I thought you didn't like Bertram Scudder.
I didn't, and I don't, but...
Then what do you care?
But he was innocent, as far as your friends were concerned, wasn't he?
I wish you wouldn't bother with politics. You talk like a fool.
He was innocent, wasn't he?
So what?
She looked at him, her eyes incredulously wide. Then they just made him the scapegoat, didn't they?
Oh, don't sit there looking like Eddie Willers.
Do I? I like Eddie Willers. He's honest.
He's a damn half-wit who doesn't have the faintest idea of how to deal with practical reality.
But you do, don't you, Jim?
You bet I do.
Then couldn't you have helped Scudder?
I?
He burst into helpless, angry laughter.
Oh, why don't you grow up? I did my best to get Scudder thrown to the lion. Somebody had to be. Don't you know that it was my neck if some other hadn't been found?
Your neck? Why not Dagny's if she was wrong? Because she wasn't.
Dagny is in an entirely different category. It had to be Scudder or me.
Why?
And it's much better for national policy to let it be Scudder. This way it's not necessary to argue about what she said, and if anybody brings it up, we start howling that it was said on Scudder's program, and that Scudder's programs have been discredited, and that Scudder is a proven fraud and liar, etc., etc. And do you think the public will be able to unscramble it? Nobody's ever trusted Bertram Scudder anyway. Oh, don't stare at me like that. Would you rather they'd picked me to discredit?
Why not Dagny? Because her speech could not be discredited?
If you're so damn sorry for Bertram Scudder, you should have seen him try his damnedest to make them break my neck. He's been doing that for years. How do you think he got to where he was except by climbing on carcasses? He thought he was pretty powerful, too. You should have seen how the big business tycoons used to be afraid of him. But he got himself outmaneuvered this time. This time he belonged to the wrong faction.
Dimly, through the pleasant stupor of relaxing, of sprawling back in his chair and smiling, he knew that this was the enjoyment he wanted. To be himself. To be himself, he thought, in the drugged, precarious state of floating past the deadliest of his blind alleys, the one that led to the question of what was himself.
You see, he belonged to the Tinky Holloway faction. It was pretty much of a seesaw for a while between the Tinky Holloway faction and the Chick Morrison faction, but we won. Tinky made a deal and agreed to scuttle his pal Bertram in exchange for a few things he needed from us. You should have heard Bertram howl, but he was a dead duck, and he knew it.
He started on a rolling chuckle, but choked it off as the haze cleared and he saw his wife's face. Jim, she whispered, is that the sort of victories you're winning?
Oh, for Christ's sake!
He screamed, smashing his fist down on the table.
Where have you been all these years? What sort of world do you think you're living in?
His blow had upset his water glass, and the water went spreading in dark stains over the lace of the tablecloth. I'm trying to find out, she whispered. Her shoulders were sagging, and her face looked suddenly worn, an odd, aged look that seemed haggard and lost.
I couldn't help it!
He burst out in the silence.
I'm not to blame. I have to take things as I find them. It's not I who've made this world.
He was shocked to see that she smiled, a smile of so fiercely bitter a contempt that it seemed incredible on her gently patient face. She was not looking at him, but at some image of her own.
That's what my father used to say when he got drunk at the corner saloon instead of looking for work. How dare you try comparing me to—
He started, but did not finish, because she was not listening. Her words, when she looked at him again, astonished him as completely irrelevant.
The date of that nationalization, September 2nd, she asked,
her voice wistful.
Was it you who picked it?
No, I had nothing to do with it. It's the date of some special session of their legislature. Why?
It's the date of our first wedding anniversary.
Oh? Oh, that's right! He smiled, relieved at the change to a safe subject. We'll have been married a year. My doesn't seem that long.
It seems much longer,
she said tonelessly. She was looking off again, and he felt in sudden uneasiness that the subject was not safe at all. He wished she would not look as if she were seeing the whole course of that year and of their marriage. Not to get scared, but to learn, she thought. The thing to do is not to get scared, but to learn.
The words came from a sentence she had repeated to herself so often that it felt like a pillar, polished smooth by the helpless weight of her body. The pillar that had supported her through the past year. She tried to repeat it, but she felt as if her hands were slipping on the polish, as if the sentence would not stave off terror any longer, because she was beginning to understand.
If you don't know, the thing to do is not to get scared, but to learn. It was in the bewildered loneliness of the first weeks of her marriage that she said it to herself for the first time. She could not understand Jim's behavior, or his sullen anger, which looked like weakness, or his evasive, incomprehensible answers to her questions, which sounded like cowardice. Such traits were not possible in the James Taggart whom she had married. She told herself that she could not condemn without understanding, that she knew nothing about his world, that the extent of her ignorance was the extent to which she misinterpreted his actions. She took the blame. She took the beating of self-reproach against some bleakly stubborn certainty which told her that something was wrong and that the thing she felt was fear.
I must learn everything that Mrs. James Taggart is expected to know and to be, was the way she explained her purpose to a teacher of etiquette. She set out to learn, with the devotion, the discipline, the drive, of a military cadet or a religious novice. It was the only way, she thought, of earning the height which her husband had granted her on trust, of living up to his vision of her, which it was now her duty to achieve. And not wishing to confess it to herself, she felt also that at the end of the long task, she would recapture her vision of him. That knowledge would bring back to her the man she had seen on the night of his railroad's triumph. She could not understand Jim's attitude when she told him about her lessons. He burst out laughing. She was unable to believe that the laughter had a sound of malicious contempt.
Why, Jim, why? What are you laughing at?
He would not explain, almost as if the fact of his contempt were sufficient and required no reasons. She could not suspect him of malice. He was too patiently generous about her mistakes. He seemed eager to display her in the best drawing rooms of the city, and he never uttered a word of reproach for her ignorance, for her awkwardness, for those terrible moments when a silent exchange of glances among the guests and a burst of blood to her cheekbones told her that she had said the wrong thing again. He showed no embarrassment. He merely watched her with a faint smile. When they came home after one of those evenings, his mood seemed affectionately cheerful. He was trying to make it easier for her, she thought, and gratitude drove her to study the harder. She expected her reward on the evening when, by some imperceptible transition, she found herself enjoying a party for the first time. She felt free to act, not by rules, but at her own pleasure, with sudden confidence that the rules had fused into a natural habit. She knew that she was attracting attention, but now, for the first time, it was not the attention of ridicule, but of admiration. She was sought after on her own merit. She was Mrs. Taggart.
She had ceased being an object of charity, weighing Jim down, painfully tolerated for his sake. She was laughing gaily and seeing the smiles of response, of appreciation on the faces around her, and she kept glancing at him across the room, radiantly, like a child handing him a report card with a perfect score, begging him to be proud of her. Jim sat alone in a corner, watching her with an undecipherable glance. He would not speak to her on their way home. "I don't know why I keep dragging myself to those parties," he snapped suddenly, tearing off his dress tie in the middle of their living room. "I've never sat through such a vulgar, boring waste of time."
"Why, Jim," she said, stunned.
"I thought it was wonderful."
"You would. You seem to be quite at home, quite as if it were Coney Island. I wish you'd learn to keep your place and not to embarrass me in public."
"I embarrassed you? Tonight?"
"You did."
"How?"
"If you don't understand it, I can't explain," he said in the tone of a mystic, who implies that a lack of understanding is the confession of a shameful inferiority.
"I don't understand it," she said firmly.
He walked out of the room, slamming the door. She felt that the inexplicable was not a mere blank this time. It had a tinge of evil. From that night on, a small hard point of fear remained within her, like the spot of a distant headlight advancing upon her down an invisible track. Knowledge did not seem to bring her a clearer vision of Jim's world, but to make the mystery greater. She could not believe that she was supposed to feel respect for the dreary senselessness of the art shows which his friends attended, of the novels they read, of the political magazines they discussed. The art shows, where she saw the kind of drawings she had seen chalked on any pavement of her childhood's slums, the novels that purported to prove the futility of science, industry, civilization, and love, using language that her father would not have used in his drunkenest moments. The magazines that propounded cowardly generalities, less clear and more stale than the sermons for which she had condemned the preacher of the slum mission as a mealy-mouthed old fraud. She could not believe that these things were the culture she had so reverently looked up to and so eagerly waited to discover. She felt as if she had climbed a mountain toward a jagged shape that had looked like a castle, and had found it to be the crumbling ruin of a gutted warehouse.
"Jim,"
she said once, after an evening spent among the men who were called the intellectual leaders of the country,
"Dr. Simon Pritchett is a phony.
A mean, scared old phony."
"Now, really," he answered, "do you think you're qualified to pass judgment on philosophers?"
"I'm qualified to pass judgment on con men. I've seen enough of them to know one when I see him."
"Now, this is why I say that you'll never outgrow your background. If you had, you would have learned to appreciate Dr. Pritchett's philosophy."
"What philosophy?"
"If you don't understand it, I can't explain."
She would not let him end the conversation on that favorite formula of his.
"Jim," she said, "he's a phony. He and Balfe Eubank and that whole gang of theirs. And I think you've been taken in by them."
Instead of the anger she expected, she saw a brief flash of amusement in the lift of his eyelids.
"That's what you think," he answered.
She felt an instant of terror at the first touch of a concept she had not known to be possible. What if Jim was not taken in by them? She could understand the phoniness of Dr. Pritchett, she thought. It was a racket that gave him an undeserved income. She could even admit the possibility by now that Jim might be a phony in his own business. What she could not hold inside her mind was the concept of Jim as a phony in a racket from which he gained nothing. An unpaid phony. An unvenal phony. The phoniness of a card sharp or a con man seemed innocently wholesome by comparison. She could not conceive of his motive. She felt only that the headlight moving upon her had grown larger. She could not remember by what steps, what accumulation of pain, first as small scratches of uneasiness, then as stabs of bewilderment, then as the chronic nagging pull of fear. She had begun to doubt Jim's position on the railroad. It was his sudden, angry, "So you don't trust me?" snapped in answer to her first innocent questions that made her realize that she did not. When the doubt had not yet formed in her mind, and she had fully expected that his answers would reassure her. She had learned, in the slums of her childhood, that honest people were never touchy about the matter of being trusted. I don't care to talk shop, was his answer whenever she mentioned the railroad. She tried to plead with him once.
Jim, you know what I think of your work, and how much I admire you for it.
Oh, really? What is it you married, a man or a railroad president?
I never thought of separating the two.
Well, it is not very flattering to me.
She looked at him, baffled. She had thought it was.
I'd like to believe, he said, that you love me for myself and not for my railroad.
Oh, God, Jim, she gasped. You didn't think that I...
No, he said, with a sadly generous smile. I didn't think that you married me for my money or my position. I have never doubted you.
Realizing in stunned confusion and in tortured fairness that she might have given him ground to misinterpret her feeling, that she had forgotten how many bitter disappointments he must have suffered at the hands of fortune-hunting women, she could do nothing but shake her head and moan,
"Oh, Jim, that's not what I meant."
He chuckled softly, as at a child, and slipped his arm around her. "Do you love me?" he asked.
"Yes," she whispered.
"Then you must have faith in me. Love is faith, you know. Don't you see that I need it? I don't trust anyone around me. I have nothing but enemies. I am very lonely. Don't you know that I need you?"
The thing that made her pace her room hours later in tortured restlessness was that she wished desperately to believe him, and did not believe a word of it, yet knew that it was true. It was true. But not in the manner he implied, not in any manner or meaning she could ever hope to grasp. It was true that he needed her, but the nature of his need kept slipping past her every effort to define it. She did not know what he wanted of her. It was not flattery that he wanted. She had seen him listening to the obsequious compliments of liars, listening with a look of resentful inertness, almost the look of a drug addict at a dose inadequate to rouse him. But she had seen him look at her as if he were waiting for some reviving shot, and at times as if he were begging. She had seen a flicker of life in his eyes whenever she granted him some sign of admiration. Yet a burst of anger was his answer whenever she named a reason for admiring. He seemed to want her to consider him great, but never dare ascribe any specific content to his greatness. She did not understand the night in mid-April when he returned from a trip to Washington. "Hi, kid," he said loudly, dropping a sheaf of lilac into her arms. "Happy days are here again. Just saw those flowers and thought of you. Spring is coming, baby." He poured himself a drink and paced the room, talking with too light, too brash a manner of gaiety. There was a feverish sparkle in his eyes, and his voice seemed shredded by some unnatural excitement. She began to wonder whether he was elated or crushed.
"I know what it is that they're planning," he said suddenly, without transition, and she glanced up at him swiftly. She knew the sound of one of his inner explosions.
"There's not a dozen people in the whole country who know it, but I do. The top boys are keeping it secret till they're ready to spring it on the nation. Will it surprise a lot of people? Will it knock them flat? A lot of people? Hell, every single person in this country. It will affect every single person. That's how important it is."
"Affect? How, Jim?"
"It will affect them. And they don't know what's coming, but I do. There they sit tonight,"
he waved at the lighted windows of the city,
"making plans, counting their money, hugging their children or their dreams, and they don't know, but I do, that all of it will be struck, stopped, changed."
"Changed? For the worse or the better?"
"For the better, of course," he answered impatiently, as if it were irrelevant.
His voice seemed to lose its fire and to slip into the fraudulent sound of duty.
"It's a plan to save the country, to stop our economic decline, to hold things still, to achieve stability and security."
"What plan?"
"I can't tell you. It's secret. Top secret. You have no idea how many people would like to know it. There's no industrialist who wouldn't give a dozen of his best furnaces for just one hint of warning, which he's not going to get. Like Hank Reardon, for instance, whom you admire so much."
He chuckled, looking off into the future.
"Jim?" she asked,
the sound of fear in her voice telling him what the sound of his chuckle had been like.
"Why do you hate Hank Reardon?"
"I don't hate him."
He whirled to her, and his face incredibly looked anxious, almost frightened.
"I never said I hated him. Don't worry, he'll approve of the plan. Everybody will. It's for everybody's good."
He sounded as if he were pleading. She felt the dizzying certainty that he was lying, yet that the plea was sincere, as if he had a desperate need to reassure her, but not about the things he said. She forced herself to smile. "Yes, Jim, of course," she answered, wondering what instinct, in what impossible kind of chaos, had made her say it, as if it were her part to reassure him. The look she saw on his face was almost a smile, and almost of gratitude. "I had to tell you about it tonight. I had to tell you. I wanted you to know what tremendous issues I deal with. You always talk about my work, but you don't understand it at all. It's so much wider than you imagine. You think that running a railroad is a matter of track laying and fancy metals and getting trains there on time, but it's not. Any underling can do that. The real heart of a railroad is in Washington. My job is politics. Politics. Decisions made on a national scale, affecting everything, controlling everybody. A few words on paper, a directive, changing the life of every person in every nook, cranny, and penthouse of this country." "Yes, Jim," she said, wishing to believe that he was perhaps a man of stature in the mysterious realm of Washington. "You'll see," he said, pacing the room. "You think they're powerful, those giants of industry who are so clever with motors and furnaces? They'll be stopped. They'll be stripped. They'll be brought down. They'll be—" He noticed the way she was staring at him. "It's not for ourselves," he snapped hastily. "It's for the people. That's the difference between business and politics. We have no selfish ends in view, no private motives. We're not after profit. We don't spend our lives scrambling for money. We don't have to. That's why we're slandered and misunderstood by all the greedy profit chasers who can't conceive of a spiritual motive or a moral ideal or—" "We couldn't help it," he cried suddenly, whirling to her. "We had to have that plan. With everything falling to pieces and stopping, something had to be done. We had to stop them from stopping. We couldn't help it." His eyes were desperate. She did not know whether he was boasting or begging for forgiveness. She did not know whether this was triumph or terror. "Jim, don't you feel well? Maybe you've worked too hard and you're worn out, and—"
"I've never felt better in my life," he snapped, resuming his pacing. "You bet I've worked hard. My work is bigger than any job you can hope to imagine. It's above anything that grubbing mechanics like Reardon and my sister are doing. Whatever they do, I can undo it. Let them build a track, I can come and break it just like that." He snapped his fingers. "Just like breaking a spine."
"You want to break spines?" she whispered, trembling.
"I haven't said that," he screamed. "What's the matter with you? I haven't said it."
"I'm sorry, Jim," she gasped, shocked by her own words and by the terror in his eyes. "It's just that I don't understand, but I know I shouldn't bother you with questions when you're so tired." She was struggling desperately to convince herself. "When you have so many things on your mind, such great things, that I can't even begin to think of." His shoulders sagged, relaxing. He approached her and dropped wearily down on his knees, slipping his arms around her.
"You poor little fool," he said affectionately.
She held on to him, moved by something that felt like tenderness and almost like pity. But he raised his head to glance up at her face, and it seemed to her that the look she saw in his eyes was part gratification, part contempt, almost as if by some unknown kind of sanction she had absolved him and damned herself. It was useless, she found in the days that followed, to tell herself that these things were beyond her understanding, that it was her duty to believe in him, that love was faith. Her doubt kept growing, doubt of his incomprehensible work, and of his relation to the railroad. She wondered why it kept growing in direct proportion to her self-admonitions that faith was the duty she owed him. Then, one sleepless night, she realized that her effort to fulfill that duty consisted of turning away whenever people discussed his job, of refusing to look at newspaper mentions of Taggart Transcontinental, of slamming her mind shut against any evidence and every contradiction. She stopped aghast, struck by the question. What is it, then? Faith versus truth? And realizing that part of her zeal to believe was her fear to know, she set out to learn the truth, with a cleaner, calmer sense of rightness than the effort at dutiful self-fraud had ever given her. It did not take her long to learn. the evasiveness of the Taggart executives when she asked a few casual questions, the stale generalities of their answers, the strain of their manner at the mention of their boss, and their obvious reluctance to discuss him, told her nothing concrete, but gave her a feeling equivalent to knowing the worst. The railroad workers were more specific, the switchmen, the gatemen, the ticket sellers, whom she drew into chance conversations in the Taggart terminal, and who did not know her. Jim Taggart, that whining, sniveling, speech-making deadhead.
Jimmy the president? Well, I'll tell you, he's the hobo on the gravy train.
The boss? Mr. Taggart? You mean Miss Taggart, don't you? It was Eddie Willers who told her the whole truth. She heard that he had known Jim since childhood, and she asked him to lunch with her. When she faced him at the table, when she saw the earnest, questioning directness of his eyes and the severely literal simplicity of his words, she dropped all attempts at casual prodding. She told him what she wanted to know and why, briefly, impersonally, not appealing for help or for pity, only for truth. He answered her in the same manner. He told her the whole story, quietly, impersonally, pronouncing no verdict, expressing no opinion, never encroaching on her emotions by any sign of concern for them, speaking with the shining austerity and the awesome power of facts. He told her who ran Taggart Transcontinental. He told her the story of the John Galt line. She listened, and what she felt was not shock, but worse, the lack of shock, as if she had always known it. "Thank you, Mr. Willers," was all that she said when he finished. She waited for Jim to come home that evening, and the thing that eroded any pain or indignation was a feeling of her own detachment, as if it did not matter to her any longer, as if some action were required of her, but it made no difference what the action would be or the consequences. It was not anger that she felt when she saw Jim enter the room, but a murky astonishment, almost as if she wondered who he was and why it should now be necessary to speak to him. She told him what she knew briefly, in a tired, extinguished voice. It seemed to her that he understood it from her first few sentences, as if he had expected this to come sooner or later. "Why didn't you tell me the truth?" she asked.
"So that's your idea of gratitude?" he screamed. "So that's how you feel after everything I've done for you? Everybody told me that crudeness and selfishness was all I could expect for lifting a cheap little alley cat by the scruff of her neck."
She looked at him as if he were making inarticulate sounds that connected to nothing inside her mind.
"Why didn't you tell me the truth?
Is that all the love you felt for me, you sneaky little hypocrite? Is that all I get in return for my faith in you?
Why did you lie? Why did you let me think what I thought?
You should be ashamed of yourself. You should be ashamed to face me or speak to me."
"I?"
The inarticulate sounds had connected, but she could not believe the sum they made.
"What are you trying to do, Jim?" she asked,
her voice incredulous and distant.
"Have you thought of my feelings? Have you thought of what this would do to my feelings? You should have considered my feelings first. That's the first obligation of any wife, and of a woman in your position in particular. There's nothing lower and uglier than ingratitude."
For the flash of one instant, she grasped the unthinkable fact of a man who was guilty and knew it and was trying to escape by inducing an emotion of guilt in his victim. But she could not hold the fact inside her brain. She felt a stab of horror, the convulsion of a mind rejecting a sight that would destroy it, a stab, like a swift recoil from the edge of insanity. By the time she dropped her head, closing her eyes, she knew only that she felt disgust, a sickening disgust, for a nameless reason. When she raised her head, it seemed to her that she caught a glimpse of him watching her with the uncertain, retreating, calculating look of a man whose trick has not worked. But before she had time to believe it, his face was hidden again under an expression of injury and anger. She said, as if she were naming her thoughts for the benefit of the rational being who was not present, but whose presence she had to assume since no other could be addressed,
"That night,